This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 3 minutes after 4 o'clock. Every Thursday, we have the opportunity to hear out-of-print records on Interval. Right now, we're going to hear some music that was unavailable, not because it was out of print, but because it was never issued at all by the record company until about a month and a half ago. It's sessions that were led by Lee Morgan. What we're going to hear is a piece that was written by drummer Mickey Roker. It's called Clotilda. After we hear this, and it's about a 3-minute piece, we're going to be joined in the studio by Mickey Roker, a Philadelphia-based jazz drummer. Hopping around to that music, it is playing at the wrong speed. And while we're getting that adjusted, let me tell you who else is featured on that record. We're going to hear Lee Morgan on trumpet, Julian Priester trombone, George Coleman tenor saxophone, Harold Mayburn at the piano, Walter Booker bass, and my guest Mickey Roker drums. It was recorded in 1969.
Work, man.
Well, we just heard a 1969 recording that was called Clotilda. It was a piece that was written by drummer Mickey Roker in a session with Lee Morgan. Mickey Roker is my guest in the studio now. He's a Philadelphia-based jazz drummer who has worked with many leading jazz musicians and most recently has been recording and touring with Dizzy Gillespie's band. Mickey Roker grew up in Philadelphia. His first experience with drums was playing in school marching bands. When he was in the Army from 1953 to 55, he played in the drum and bugle corps there. When he got out of the Army, he started playing jazz. He lived in Philly until 1959, then moved to New York, first for an extended stay with Gigi Grice at the Five Spot. During the 1960s, he played with pianist Ray Bryant, with blues singer Joe Williams, and played as a sideman for Milt Jackson, Clifford Jordan, Sonny Rollins, and Art Farmer, among others. He's recorded with most of the musicians that I just mentioned, as well as with Herbie Hancock, Stanley Turrentine, and Horace Silver. He's on Mary Lou Williams' recent records and appeared at the Cecil Taylor Mary Lou Williams Carnegie Hall concert. Since 1971, he's been playing and touring with Dizzy Gillespie's band and is featured on recent Gillespie albums on the Pablo record label. After living in New York for about 18 years, Mickey Roker has moved back to Philadelphia about a year ago, where he lives now, although he's actually very frequently out of town on tour with Dizzy Gillespie's band, both in the States and in other countries. Mickey Roker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I didn't know I did all that.
There it is. Well, what I'd like to do is go backwards in time a bit and work our way back up to the present and listen to some of your recordings as we talk. You started playing with marching bands and drum and bugle corps. Now, I know when I was growing up, that was the kind of music you weren't supposed to like. It wasn't hip to like marching band music. When you were growing up, did you enjoy playing in those bands? Was that a great experience?
I loved it. I loved it with a passion because that was my only chance to play the drums. It didn't matter what kind of music was played, just the sound of the drums was inviting. So that was all that was available at that age for me, you know.
What were you listening to on the radio at that time? Or, you know,
oh, man, we listened at everything on the radio because that's all that was happening in those times when I was a kid. You see, TV was just coming in, like when I was like maybe 10 or 12. You know, it probably had been in, but didn't come into our neighborhood until about maybe 10 or 12 years old. And during that time, we didn't have a TV right away, you know. So we listened at everything on the radio. I learned all the melodies from listening at them on the radio.
Jazz, R&B?
Well, I mean, just standard tunes. You know, you would listen at standard tunes. And then they had the blues tunes, too. You would buy a little 45 records, you know. But that was my only opportunity to play. Like, I played in junior high school orchestra, snare drum. And then I played in O.V. Cattle, Bugle and Drum Corps, snare drum.
You did some playing in South Philly around 16th and Fitzwater at the Elks?
Yeah, that was the Elks. That was the Bugle and Drum Corps I was in when I was very young.
Do you go, well, you went to the Army in the early 50s and mm-hmm. did some playing there. What was the musical scene like then?
Well, the musical scene is military.
Yeah.
And then, like, the guys would get together at the service club, like, after they finished working, and they would have, like, sessions, you know, guys get together and play. And I didn't have drums when I was in the Army, see, so the other guy had the drums, so he saw how interested I was, so he would help me and show me little things, and he would let me play a little bit, you know, but I didn't really know exactly what to do with everything, you know, because I had only been playing military drums. I didn't know what to do with my feet, you know. So he showed me, and I practiced, and when I came out, you know, we started having sessions at my house. We used to have sessions down there.
In Philadelphia?
Yeah, in Philly, and the guys used to come down, and we would play, and that's how I really learned how to get my coordination together at those sessions, you know, and then I learned about rhythm.
Who showed up at those sessions? Anyone whose names
man,
you
Lee
might
Morgan,
know
McCoy Tyner, Arthur Harper, Reggie Workman, Jimmy Vass, C. Sharp. Oh, so many guys, I can't remember them all. Hassan, strong piano player, you know, influenced by Monk and Bud Powell. But he had his own personality, you know. And then there was a saxophone player named Odine Pope, who they played together quite a bit. I made a few gigs with them, and a bass player by the name of Eddie Mathias. And with those cats, we would have different places where we would go have sessions. And like on Sunday, it was my time to have a session at my house, see? So my grandma would cook, man, and my uncle bought a piano for me, man. He went in debt, man, you know. He went, you know, to try to help me further my musical education. Because he always wanted to play, you know. But he never had enough patience to sit down and practice. And so when I would hear my uncle practicing, I would memorize it, you know. And then I'd jump on his instrument and learn it, you know.
Did you know how to read music at this time?
No.
Is it important for a drum player to be able to read music?
Is it what?
Important for a drum player.
I think it's important for a musician to know how to read music. Sure. You know, some people are trained formally and some they have to get it, you know, in the street.
Who were the drummers who are very, you know, important to you when you were playing at this time in Philly?
Philly Joe Jones. Specs Wright. And there's another drummer named Al Jones. He lived in South Philly. And he didn't, you know, he would always get himself in trouble, and I would lend him my drums, you know, I would let him use my drums. And I would go on a gig with him, and he would let me play, like, on the last sets, you know. And he showed me a lot of stuff.
So you'd go to clubs and listen to these people play. Which were the clubs that you'd hang out at that time?
Well, at that time, when I really wanted to play the set of drums, I was old enough to go into clubs, like the Showboat and the Pep Bar. Well, the Pep Bar is no longer, and then they had the Blue Note, and the Rendezvous, and then there was, oh man, lots of small places to play, like where we played, you know. We played in a place, the Sahara, and a place called the Woodbine, and, oh man, places up in Germantown, I can't even remember the names of them. But I met Bill Cosby up in one of those places one time.
Oh.
He always wanted to play drums, you know.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, and he was in school during the time when I was just coming up around Philly playing, and he would come out and hear me play, you know. In fact, I didn't even realize this until he told it to me, you know.
That's great.
He came up, he said, I heard him one time in and in, and he was so funny, you know. He did a thing about Noah's Ark.
Oh, sure, I remember hearing that on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was one of his first routines that he did on TV.
Yeah, and I went up and I said, man, that was really funny, you know. So he said, oh, Mickey Rocco, man, I know you from Philly, you know. So, but anyway, you know, he's a beautiful cat.
Well, in 1959 it was that you left Philly for New York to play with Gigi Grice's band. How did you get hooked up with that?
Well, Reggie Workman is a bass player. And he had been trying to get me to go to New York before to play with Gigi, but I had a day job and I was married and I had two small kids, so I couldn't really, you know, I couldn't just quit my day job and go, you know. Well, that was the decision I made. Well, anyway, I lost my day job. And it just happened that I had a chance to go to New York and play. You know, it was just a job. You know, I didn't figure it was the end of the world or it was the beginning of, you know, everything is a beginning, you know. So I talked with my wife and I said, look, I got a chance to go to New York. She said, well, go play, man. So I went and played, you know.
You played at the Five Spot.
Yeah, that was our first gig. We played there two weeks, and then the following 2 weeks, that's when Arnett Coleman came to town with Billy Higgins and Don Cherry
so
and that band.
Oh, so you got to hear him play when you first arrived. What did you think of him
It was interesting, and my head wasn't there. You know, you got to... They played the type of music back in that time that you had to acquire a taste for, you know. It wasn't conventional. It wasn't the blues. It was, though. It's hard to explain a feeling, you know. You have to hear it yourself in order to know what was happening.
If you're just tuning in now, I'm speaking with drummer Mickey Rocker, and I think we should listen now to what is the first record.
My first endeavor?
Yeah. It's a session with Gigi Grice, who is the person whose band you first worked with in New York. Do you want to say a little bit about the session and who's on it and what you remember?
Well, man, that happened so long ago. I remember all the guys on the session. On bass was Reggie Workman. Trumpet was Richard Williams. And on piano was Richard Wines, and Gigi Grice on alto, and myself.
Were you nervous at being your first session?
I was so scared, man. I had never played with so many microphones around me before, you know. And they were just staring at me, you know. Well, I mean, I was afraid because it takes a long, you know, when you had only been playing a short time in a professional status like I was playing in, it takes a while before you really get your confidence, you know. And I wasn't really, it was just a lack of confidence that had me nervous, you know. Because if a guy wants you to record with him, you must have something that he likes, you know, musically or rhythmically, whatever you want to say. So, you know, but I was still nervous. I'm not going to say I wasn't nervous, man. But you got to overcome your fear or you'll die.
Right.
You know?
Okay, well, this is a piece called Backbreaker. It's from an album called Saying Something, the Gigi Grice Quintet. It's the first album that Mickey Roker recorded on.
Thank you.
heard from Gigi Grice with my guest Mickey Roker on drums, and that was a selection from the first album that he was featured on. My guest is Mickey Roker, a Philadelphia-based jazz drummer who is actually spending a lot of time out of town, touring very frequently with the Dizzy Gillespie Band. We're taking things pretty chronologically here through Mickey's very, very big career in jazz. Now, let's see, we left off... having come in about 1959 to New York to play with Gigi Grice at the Five Spot. Now, that was the first record that you recorded. When was the last time you heard it? Did you listen to it?
Oh, man, I haven't listened to that record in a couple years at least.
Uh-huh. Okay. When you finished playing with Gigi Grice's band, you did a lot of work with a lot of different musicians, Milt Jackson, Sonny Rollins, Clifford Jordan, Art Farmer.
That was all, like, after Gigi.
It was after Gigi,
oh, yeah. Gigi was my first taste of New York.
But then you went on to play with a lot of...
Right. When I left Gigi, I played with Ray Bryant. He's another Philadelphia pianist. I understand he's living there now, too.
Oh, is he living in Philly?
Yes. And I played with him for like a couple years, and then I left him and I went to play with Junior Mance and Joe Williams. Junior Mance was the trio that was accompanying Joe Williams, because he was gonna get a chance to go to Europe, and I had never been to Europe, you see. So I took that job and it worked out nice. I stayed with him, me and Bob Crenshaw. We stayed together for a couple years and we got to be good, very good friends through that. We all are still, you know. And you want me to go on? Or
oh, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, and after Joe Williams, then I stayed around New York for a while because I wanted to learn how to read. I had to go to study and learn how to read. So I was lucky to get a study job, working on 52nd Street at the Hickory House with Mary Lou Williams. Me and a bass player named Larry Gales. He played with Eddie Lockjaw Davis and Johnny Griffin when they had their band. Well, he liked me, and we used to have fun together, so we enjoyed playing. So the drummer had to leave. The drummer was a drummer who was at the time playing with Harry Belafonte. His name is Percy Bryce. So he had to leave, so I took his place. And we stayed there like 7 months. And so I had a chance to really get a foothold in the reading, you know. I got a teacher. His name is Charlie Perry. Looked just like Maynard Ferguson, too. We used to call him Maynard, you know. We didn't call him Maynard. We called him Maynard, you know. And he was very good. He made stuff very easy for me to understand. And with practice and a little practical application, then I learned how to become a pretty good reader. I'm still not what you call I couldn't go sit in a symphony, you know what I mean? But I can read along with what I hear good enough to make a living, you know what I mean? And that's what I was trying to do, because during those times I was lucky enough to be working so much till I could only study so much, you know?
Did you think that you would be able to make, a long-time career of your music at that time?
Well, I just live in hope, you know. Mm-hmm. You never know what tomorrow's going to bring, you know. I don't take it for granted that today's cool and tomorrow's going to be cool, because you never know.
Have most people who you've worked with asked you to play with them because they've, you know, seen and heard you play, or like through records?
It's personal, yeah. Most in jazz or in any you know, form of music, when a guy wants you to work with his band, it's personal. Some guys take a chance on you, you know, because you're recommended, but it's still personal. You're recommended by somebody, or a lot of times you work in a band and the guy's never heard you before, especially when you're young, coming in like that, you know.
I just before went through a list of people you'd played with after mm-hmm. Ray Bryan and Joe Williams, actually, Milt Jackson and Rollins and Clifford Jordan. Did you have to, you know, like kind of change your playing in any way to adapt yourself to these different personalities?
Well, you have to be yourself. You have to be yourself. Now, certain people expect certain things of you that are mechanical things, like if he wants a certain rhythm here or he wants an accent here, if it's certain, but your own personal way to play, that's why they hire you, is because of your personal feeling, see?
Who's the most demanding leader that you've worked with over the years?
Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah?
Yeah, man.
Who is the most fun to work?
I mean, they're all fun and they're all demanding, because if you don't come up with some quality, you're not going to be there. You know, so it's up to you how much demands they put on you. You know, if you're working with a person, you got to understand where they're coming from, because from a drummer's viewpoint, you got to pacify them before you get a chance to say how you feel. See, your main thing is to pacify them. You see? So the demand is on you right away. It's always on the drummer. You got to be on time. See?
How did you get to meet Sonny Rollins and to play with him?
I met Sonny Rollins through Bob Crenshaw, bass player, who they played together in Chicago, and they're like good friends for years. And me and Bob had played with Junior Mance and Joe Williams and Mary Lou Williams, because he also joined that steady gig I had in the Hickory House. I got him the job on that. And we played together with many people, me and Bob Crenshaw. And so he's responsible for me working with Sonny Rollins.
You recorded an album, which we don't have with us today, with Rollins. How did you like playing together?
Oh, he's something. He's strong. He's just, you know, during those times, most of my playing were like with trios, because I could play good with brushes. It's just a talent I had. I could play very good soft. I could play soft. You know, and drums is a very difficult instrument to play soft. You see, so it was a challenge for me during those times to play with Sonny, because it was a complete opposite volume-wise, you see. I had to always play, you know, like playing with trios. Like, you can't, even playing with singers, you got to play under them, you know, or it's not going to be balanced, you know. So when I got to play with Sonny Rollins and Art Farmer and bands like that, it was, oh, man, like, it was a new, you know, a new ray of light, like, you know. And it's anything that's different is a challenge, you know. It's good for you to try to come up with something that you don't know how to do all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mickey Rucker, let's listen to another record that you are featured on. And this is from an album called Sweet Honeybee. It's with the Duke Pearson Band. Yeah. And Freddie Hubbard is featured on it, Joe Henderson, Ron Carter. We're going to hear a piece called Sudell. Do you want to say a few words about this session before we hear it?
Well, it was a very beautiful session. And like Duke Pearson, who's a very good friend of mine, and he happens to be sick right now, but you know, he really helped me out a lot musically. You know, he really, well, we helped each other, you know, but he was responsible for me doing a lot of recordings in the 60s.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording with the Duke Pearson Band and my guest Mickey Rucker on drums.
Thank you.
We've just heard Soudelle, a composition by Duke Pearson, who was featured at the piano, along with Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Ron Carter bass, and my guest Mickey Roker on drums. Mickey Roker, if you're just tuning in, is a drummer who is now, since about 1971 actually, touring, recording, and playing with the Dizzy Gillespie Band. He's in Philadelphia for a time in between tours, so we're very glad to have the opportunity to have you, Mickey, on Fresh Air this afternoon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, let's see. Let's talk a little bit about working with Dizzy Gillespie. How did you get to, you know, play with him as a pretty regular member of the band?
Well, I had been working with Lee Morgan.
And from about 69 to 71.
Yeah, a couple years, maybe 2.5 years. Well, anyway, Dizzy loves Lee Morgan. You know, most trumpet players love Dizzy, you know. And if Dizzy digs you, he'll come and hear you, you know. So he used to come and hear us. And also in the band, when I was in the band with Lee Morgan, was one of Dizzy's favorite bass players, a bass player named Jimmy Merritt, who also lives in Philly now. Well, you know, Dizzy loves the music, and he would come out and hear, so he needed a drummer, you know, and he invited me to do a television show with him. And it went so well at the time, he wanted me and Sam Jones, the bass player, to come play with him. Well, man, I had been knowing Dizzy since I was very young, because me and Dizzy's nephew, Dizzy's mother and most of his family was in Philadelphia, right about a block away from my house. In fact, I waited. I didn't say anything about this before, but I wanted to wait for the right time. But me and Dizzy's nephew, named Harold Gillespie, we started out playing together at the same time. You know, we wanted to really play. And we went all through school together, me and Dizzy's nephew. And I never said anything to this about Dizzy, you know. He thought he had me confused with another drummer named Pete LaRocca. So I didn't say anything to Dizzy. I waited. I just waited. And I had been working in his band about maybe 6 months or something. So we were working in New York at a place called the Baron, the Club Baron. And his brother, see, Dizzy didn't know me. You know, he would see me. In fact, one time when I was about maybe 16 or 17, before I went in the Army, Dizzy took me with him on one of his gigs, me and his nephew. We took us up to the place called the Blue Note to hear him play. And I, you know, so anyway, we working up at the Club Baron, and Dizzy's brother and his sister came in. They came in the club, you know, so they walked by the bandstand, and he turned around, and he looked at me, and Wesley, his name is Wesley, Dizzy's brother, and he looked, and he recognized me, you know, so he said, "Mickey Roker." And Dizzy turned around and said, "Man, you know that guy?" I said, "Yeah, that's your brother, and that's your sister, you know." And you know, like we that just made us tight, you know, because I didn't try to use anything to get to work with Dizzy. You know, I always, who don't want to play with Dizzy, man? Every, you know, because rhythmically speaking, he knows a lot, you know.
Were you pretty familiar with most of his records?
Oh, of course. You raised on, if you come up in the era I came up in, you raised on Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker.
Well, so is a lot of the audience who come out to hear him when he plays. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, if you all play the bop standards and the music that everyone associates with Dizzy Gillespie when you play either on a tour or through Europe or in
the
States.
Well, we do some of it. You know, we don't do all. We do new things now because new things are happening all the time. And you can't just keep staying and eating the same meal every day. You know what I mean? The music is good and it's great and people love it. And we play, periodically, we play some of the older tunes from the bebop era. But now, the Brazilian music is so effective, you know. And the blues and the rock, too. We play the rock, too. I try to play the rock, you know. But the rhythm, I play the rhythm. I'm not a rock player, you know. That bass drum, man, that bass drum, man, that's something else.
But you want to be playing this. It's not, you know, like the pressure from the
play
audience
the drums.
Or from recording companies to play rock rhythms.
I just want to play the drums. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I've never been the type of drummer, man, that just wanted to play one kind of music. I like all the music. I think it's all good if it's according to how you play it.
You've recorded with Dizzy Gillespie a number of albums on the Pablo record label, mm-hmm. which is owned by Norman Granz, who's been in the music production business for years and mm-hmm. years, and you know, did Verve Records mm-hmm. for a long time. What's he like to work?
He's good to work for. Because if you work for Norman, he wants you there. You see, so he's good. I mean, he's good to work for.
How much time do you have for an album, for instance, to be produced? Like, if you're called into the studio, you know, and you're going to do an album, how much time?
It's up to you.
Uh-huh.
It's up to you, you know, because if you play well, then you can do an album and you can do one side in one take. You know, like most of the albums I've done has been done in one day or 2 days. They do 3 hours one day and 3 hours the next day. And you get a tune each hour.
You've also recorded with Milt Jackson for the CTI record.
Yeah, that's one of my best friends, Milt Jackson, man.
Was that a really different kind of recording context for that?
Well, he records for CTI when we did this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just good music, you know. You just try to play good music. Guys are bringing arrangements, or somebody will, you make one up right there, or you know. It's the only thing different is there's nothing different. You know, everything's the same. Only thing changes your attitude about it. You know, your attitude might not be so, or your attitude might really be up. You know, it's up to you. The player, speaking from the player viewpoint, nothing can stop you from playing well. You know, the only thing that make you play bad is you.
Must be hard when, you know, you're having a bad day. You just know it's a bad day, but
you've
got
to go out and perform. Well, sometimes you got to overcome that. You can't have too many bad days.
Yeah, right.
You know, but you can't.
Well, let's listen. I wish we had more time, but we have time to listen to a part of an album that I'm sure a lot of people who are listening now are familiar with. It's called mm-hmm. Speak Like a Child, and
oh,
it was recorded with Herbie Hancock. Do you want to say a few words about the session before we hear it?
Well, playing with Herbie Hancock's always beautiful, man. The man is such an amazing musician, man. And he plays with so much feeling, man, until it's got to be fun if you love to play. You know, then it's easier to play with guys it's fun to play with.
Let's hear a little of it. Herbie Hancock with Mickey Roker on drums.
Thank you.
We're listening to Speak Like a Child with Herbie Hancock. My guest Mickey Roker featured on drums on that recording. We're leaving that recording midway through it, so we have a few more minutes to talk with Mickey Roker before the show ends this afternoon. Well, when was the last time you heard that record?
I love
the way musicians, you know, deal with their own music and never have a chance to listen to it.
Well, you know, when you first do a record, then you listen at it 89 times, you know what I mean? And because you can always hear something that you should have done, or you can hear something that you shouldn't have done, you know what I mean? And you'd be listening because you, the next time you're presented with that situation, you don't want to do that, or you might want to do it. And then when you get listening at it until you, if you listen at it 80, if you listen at it 90 times, then you like the record, you know. So, but I haven't really listened at any records other than the radio, you know, for... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't listen like I used to when I was younger, you know.
There was a concert that you were at Carnegie Hall, I guess about a couple of years ago, the Mary Lou Williams and Cecil Taylor concert, mm-hmm. which was expected to be an incredible coming together of two different traditions. Mm-hmm. Mary Lou Williams, who started back with Andy Crick's Clouds of Joy in the mid-30s, and Cecil Taylor, who's been on the vanguard of the avant-garde for a number of years now. Now, you've recorded a number of records with Mary Lou Williams and even played with her in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here was this concert where they were both playing together, two pianos, Mary Lou Williams and Cecil Taylor, with the addition of the rhythm section for some of the tunes. How did you feel about that? Was it a comfortable setting? Were you pleased
with
the results?
Well, you know, when you're working, sometimes you have days, man, when... See, because it's not just you. There are people that... you have to work with sometimes that I don't know how to say this, you know. I don't know whether it was comfortable. It was strange. See, because now I understand where Mary Lou's coming from, because we're both from the blues and from, you know, the progressive jazz. But Cecil Taylor, I just don't understand. You know, and understanding is greater than love. If you don't understand, it's hard for you to deal. I'm not saying that it should be comfortable. It can't be comfortable until you get a little more understanding of what's happening, see? And so, you know, it wasn't my cup of tea. But being a professional, you can't... It's not always your cup of tea. You got to learn how to deal with a situation that's not comfortable. That makes you, broadens your scope a little more, see? So that's all I can say about the album. You know, it's music, and some people will like it and some people might not like it so much.
Do you like it?
I haven't really heard it.
Okay.
I don't even have the album
yet.
Do I have this album? Well, I must have just got it. It just came. But I haven't listened at it yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You little devil, you.
When you've done session work, you've been a sideman on the albums that you've recorded for.
Uh-huh.
Has that been a comfortable arrangement for you? Would you have preferred lead sessions?
Just playing the drums is comfortable. Now, whatever the capacity, it really doesn't matter. Whether I'm the lead man, the only reason why I've never thought about being a leader is because, like, in my raising, like, in musical coming up, I would notice that any time a guy would become a band leader, then none of the other guys would call him for work, you see? So, not that I was worried, but I like to play with different people because it's a different understanding you have to have. Even if it's not comfortable, it's still a challenge to your mentality to try to do something that you've never done before, you see? And when I was coming up, you didn't get that kind of opportunity once you become a leader and start having gigs on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to play all the time, see? And if one guy wasn't working, then there was another guy that was working, see? Because, you know, I just want to play, you know? I didn't want to be sitting in the home, you know, with an ego because I'm a band leader, you know? Or sitting home with a pocket full of money, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You lived in New York for about 18 years. You grew up in Philly, lived in New York for about 18 years, and returned to Philly, I guess, about a year ago.
Right.
Has the place changed a lot to you?
Yes, it has changed. Like, most of my friends and that are 18 years older now, and they're walking a little slower, you know? And the facial value has changed because a lot of the places that were slums and, like, where I lived before, they're fixing it all up now, you know? And I don't know what's happening musically. I know Philadelphia's always been a good town, you know, and good musicians are always jump up from Philadelphia. But I don't know what's happening with as far as making a living in Philly is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Do you like the touring life, touring as frequently as you do now?
Sure.
Do you get
It's interesting, man, and it's educational. It's hard work. Huh? There's nothing that's easy work, you dig? But when you work with a band, and I always like to work with a band, and then when the band is off, if maybe somebody else needs a drummer or something, they'll call me and it's exciting, that, you know. But in order to maintain a full stomach, and heat in your house, it's, you know, if you're fortunate enough to, it's nice to work with a band and really get some tight music together so that you can play something for people that's really sounds like it's been rehearsed, you know, because when you just job around, a lot of times it sounds like a jam session, and I like to play when a unit just sounds tight regardless as to the nobody's the greatest musician in the world. But if you get four guys that really work hard, they can come together and you can come up with something that's with quality.
So you like to really combine, you know, improvisation with structure.
Oh,
with,
yeah. I like to be in a situation, but I also like to be somewhat free within the situation to use my own mind, you know. I don't want nobody telling me every beat to play because then, I mean, what I practiced 89 years for somebody to tell me every beat. You know what I mean? I like to have a certain freedom inside a situation.
You were telling me that you really like now some Cuban and Brazilian rhythms.
Yeah.
Have you spent time in both of those countries?
Well, I went to Cuba for once. I stayed there like a day and a half. And I heard about
Is that for that big
6 years of music.
that happened there that Dizzy Gillespie went to and David Amram. And
yeah, and Stan Getz.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. That was a beautiful concert. We played on this boat, see? And we went down on this boat, and we played, like, on the boat. And then we had one big concert down in Havana? Yeah, Havana.
So how has that influenced your drumming, hearing Brazilian and Cuban rhythms, being in
Well,
those countries,
I've always been influenced by, you know, cats that play good. You know, I don't care what the ancestry. If it's good, then it influences me, you know. I want to, you know, when I grow up, I want to be just like that.
We're almost out of time, but before we have to end the show, which are some of your favorite records, of the records that you featured on, and I know that you don't have a chance to listen to your records a lot. Which are you most pleased with? Are the ones you're on, yeah.
I like this one here, this one you're getting ready to play.
The
now.
One we're about to hear with Mel Jackson.
Olenga.
Yeah.
I love that album, and I also love the Sudell album.
The one that we heard a little earlier.
Mm-hmm. I did a record with Frank Foster that I like, too, but I couldn't bring too many, you know. But there are certain tracks on most all the albums I made that I enjoy, and I don't enjoy all of them, you know, because nothing is all, you know. And there are certain records I made I can't stand and listen to it. I just can't stand and listen at them. They just make me nauseous, you know?
I guess I shouldn't ask you which those are.
Well, I don't think about them. I mean, I listen at them because you have to hear yourself in a bad light just like you hear yourself in a good light, you know? You can't just listen at the good all the time. But, I mean, I really listen at them and, man, but it's not music. If I don't enjoy it, then it's not pleasing. It's not music. If you don't enjoy it, you know, I don't want to torture myself.
Well, coming up, we're going to hear one of those albums that you really like a lot. It's Olenga. It's a record with Milt Jackson and Cedar Walton and Ron Carter, Jimmy Heath, my guest Mickey Roker on drums. Before we hear that, Mickey Roker, I want to thank you enormously for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks
in between
for
your
me.
Tours around
and my wife,
here
Priscilla.
And there.
Say something in the way of the mic, sugar.
Hello.
Thanks for being here, too. And that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. If you've just joined us, I've been speaking with Mickey Roker, who is a jazz drummer who plays and has played with a lot of people, including Dizzy Gillespie, who he plays with now, Mary Lou Williams, on whose recent recordings you can hear him.